Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on the 9th of August, year 2011. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk to Wayne Reglin and also Cammy Bardness about this Golden North Salmon Derby coming up this weekend. Also, we'll talk to Darren Snyder about next week's 4-H Sustainable Harvest Camp. We'll also learn a little bit more about the play that's coming up at Perseverance Theater from new theater group in town. And then we'll also hear the Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more today on a Juneau afternoon. For the forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain later on, low temperatures around 49 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, showers are likely with high temperatures around 59 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, showers likely with high temperatures around 59 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Susan Rice, says the U.S. is working on change in Native communities, for example, investing in high-speed broadband infrastructure to expand access to health care and strengthen public safety. Rice says the U.S. is renewing its commitment to Native Americans and asks for collaboration from indigenous communities. The statements were made to mark the International Day of the World's Indigenous People. This year's observance highlights stories and culture with indigenous people expressing their identity through art, designs, stories, and traditions. Indian country is bearing the biggest brunt of climate change, according to a new report from tribal groups and the National Wildlife Federation. More frequent extreme weather is detailed, like droughts, floods, wildfires, and snowstorms. Kim Gottschalk with the Native Americans Rights Fund explains the impact of ecological damage.
They depend on these systems for their spiritual, cultural, and economic welfare. And yet, despite their historically low carbon footprint, have been disproportionately affected by climate change.
Jose Aguto with the National Congress of American Indians says Native nations face challenges but have natural resource expertise to share through collaboration with federal, state, and local governments.
They have practices that are time-tested, climate resilient, sustainable, bountiful, and cost-effective.
He says some of the richest renewable energy resources in North America are on tribal lands, but it's difficult to find capital or investors, and most federal incentives are not available to tribes. The study asks Congress to boost funding for conservation and climate adaptation projects through the Bureau of Indian Affairs and to repeal tribal exclusion from federal environmental programs. In Canada, a new report shows a better financial picture for First Nations compared to previous years. Tim Fontaine has more.
TD Economics provides financial analysis of markets around the world for banks and investors. In July, they published a report estimating the size of the Aboriginal market in Canada that puts the combined incomes of Aboriginal businesses, governments, and people at $24 billion in 2011, double what it was in just 2001. Clint Davis is president and CEO of the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business, a partner in the study.
We've heard of various studies and reports that talk about, you know, if Aboriginal people were at full employment, then the contribution to the country could be an extra, you know, $100 billion to the GDP and so on. And that's fine. I mean, those reports are valuable. But it's sort of something that's out there in the future. What this report says is what is happening right now.
The report credits Aboriginal governments, so-called Aboriginal Economic Development Corporations, and small business for the rise in incomes. Kathy Isaac is one of those entrepreneurs. She's owner of Bearpaw Music and Gifts in Whitehorse, the largest city in the Yukon Territory.
Mostly First Nation customers, but this year is the first year that I've had to address that I'm getting a lot of European shoppers within the store, and I've had to change a little bit of my marketing mix.
Despite the rosy outlook of the report, Clint Davis admits there are still problems in First Nation communities. But with Aboriginal incomes expected to balloon to $64 billion by 2016, it's hard not to be optimistic.
That was Tim Fontaine reporting from Canada. During this month in 1987, the U.S. Postal Service issued a 10-cent stamp in honor of Chief Red Cloud. The Oglala Lakota leader led a successful war against the United States, which eventually led to the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
If you are a Native American who experienced discrimination from the USDA while trying to get a farm loan, you could get a payment of up to $50,000 or more. There will be meetings in locations around the country between July and December 2011 where you can get free legal help filing a claim. More details and a full schedule of meetings is available at IndianFarmClass.com or 1-888-233-5506.
With funding by the Washington, D.C., Albuquerque, and Alaska law firm of Sanofsky, Chambers, Saxby, Anderson, Miller, and Munson. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05, and you are tuned to KTOO News in here on a Juneau afternoon. Our first guest is here to talk about the Salmon Derby, which is coming up August 12th through the 14th. It's the 65th annual Derby. Wayne Regland and Cammie Barnes, thank you very much for coming to the station today and talking about it.
Well, thank you for having us.
So an overview for the first timer who's never been in a Salmon Derby before.
Well, the Derby starts Friday morning at 7:30. You have to have a fishing license and buy a Derby ticket, which costs $40, unless you're 12 or under, and then it's $10. And then we weigh in fish at three places. People catch fish, bring them in, and weigh them if they think it's big enough to get one of the top 65 prizes. And if they don't think that it's a big enough fish, then they just turn it into us, and we call them scholarship fish. And we take those fish and sell them, and the money for the fish sales goes to scholarships for junior high school graduates that are going on to college or to vocational school.
And you're limited to where you can fish from.
We expanded the boundaries of the Derby a few years ago, so you can fish almost everywhere around Juneau that people would want to go, all the way down to Cooverton, clear down to the Snettisham that way. So people can go a long ways. We expanded the boundaries because there was no sense in limiting them if they wanted to go a long ways.
Do you have to be in a boat?
You must fish from a boat. And every year people ask that because some people would like to fish from shore. But since we sell the fish, we even sell the fish we weigh. So we sell all the fish and we can't take them from the land because a lot of times the fish that are caught in streams or from shore are in much more poor condition. So we only take fish from boats. And we only take king salmon and only take silver salmon. The limit, you have to follow the fish and game rules on the limits, and you can get six silver salmon. They have to be over 16 inches. And you can get three king salmon, but they have to be over 28 inches.
This is sponsored by the Territorial Sportsman. Can you educate me about the Territorial Sportsman, please?
Territorial Sportsman has been in existence in Juneau since 1947. It's just a group that's interested in hunting and fishing and trapping and promoting those activities and trying to fight for good rules and regulations and access for hunting and fishing. There's about 1,800 members.
How many people are involved in the Salmon Derby?
Well, I said last year, I believe we sold about 1,800 tickets. So then that's pretty steady numbers from years past. It's gradually increased, I'd say. So anywhere from like 1,500 to 2,000 is usually the number of tickets we sell every year.
And how does it break down as far as age range?
I would say probably maybe 20% or so would be 12 and under.
Yeah, around there, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of kids fish it.
Yeah, a lot of kids do fish it.
I know the oldest person that will fish it this year is Dick Garrison. He'll be 92, and he's fished in all 65 derbies.
And we had some discussion a few minutes earlier before we went on the air about the number of men versus women that fish in the Salmon Derby, and there wasn't a clear answer.
No, that's actually a really good question, but I would say that it's actually pretty even. There's a lot of couples that go out, and that's actually a good question because I'm actually going to try to keep track of it this year and try to get an answer for you next year. So there's a lot of women fishing it, too.
I understand Sandy Williams is involved big time this year, but you're looking for somebody new to take over the helm of them.
Well, yes, this year Sandy is co-chair along with me. It's Sandy's second year, and I think he'll probably step down. So we're always looking for people that want to volunteer. We have about 100 volunteers that work during the Derby, but and that's A lot of people want to do that because it's a short period of time, but we really could use some more volunteers that want to be involved in organizing the Derby, soliciting prizes from the businesses, and organizing it and making it all run. And that takes quite an effort. We need a core group of about 12, but the big one we need is a couple chairs, chairmen.
How do the prizes work?
We'll give, there's prizes for the first 65 fish, or the largest 65 fish. It doesn't make any difference if they're king salmon or silver salmon. And then we have a lot of special prizes, too. The first place fish, the biggest fish caught, gets $10,000 cash, plus about $1,500 worth of other things like belt buckles and a jacket and a big trophy and things like that. That prize with the least value is worth $953. So all of the prizes are very good. The 50th place fish is worth the 50th largest fish is worth $5,000 because that's a special prize donated by Hugh and Sherry Grant to celebrate 50 years in business for Hugh Grant in Juneau. He owns Grant's Plaza and where Western Auto is, and always been a longtime Derby supporter. So that is a big prize. But all of them are very nice prizes. All of them have quite a lot of cash in them.
And awards night itself, the first place winner gets the first pick, and then what goes down from there?
Well, there are four prizes that are restricted. The first place always gets first prize. The third place fish is restricted, only if the 50th, because that's for the person that actually catches the third largest fish gets third prize. The 50th fish gets 50th, and the 65th fish always gets that prize because it's worth $2,300. And the third prize is a special prize this year. We call it the Frank Gillespie Memorial Prize. He died in April, and his friends have come together, and that prize is significantly larger, or will be significantly larger than prize number two. So it's restricted. Only the person that catches it will get that prize. And we don't know the exact amount because they've been at Bullwinkle's. They've been collecting money in an urn for the last few months, and they'll count that money, and we'll announce on Saturday morning how much money that prize is worth. But they think there's several hundred dollars worth of extra money. So that prize will probably be worth, you know, $28,000, $29,000, $30,000.
But you have to buy a ticket to qualify.
You have to buy a ticket to fish, and everybody that is on the boat needs to have a ticket, unless it's a little kid or something.
So it's Derby morning, and you have your Derby ticket, and you have to take off and get it stamped?
What you do, I'll let Cammie, she takes care of the docks, and I'll let her explain about validation.
Just 7:30 on Friday morning, we can start validating, and we have the three way stations, which are Amalga, Douglas, and Auk Bay, we can all validate there, as well as T Harbor, North Douglas, Aurora Harbor, Harris Harbor, and Fisherman's Bend. So there's plenty of places, and you show us your Derby ticket, and we'll put a special little punch in there, and then you're on your way, and you're good for the whole weekend. You only have to have it validated one time.
And you're not doing a tagged fish this year, or you haven't done it for the past few years?
In place of the tagged fish, we do these things that are called high fives. Everybody that turns in a scholarship fish gets a ticket that has a number on it, and it's those tickets where there's duplicate tickets. So we have one, and the people that turn in the fish get one. And so we're going to give away several thousand of those tickets if we get that many fish. Then we draw from those tickets, and people can participate in these high five contests. There's two of them for $25,000 and one for $50,000 potential winnings. And two of them come from the scholarship drawings, and one comes from just a drawing from a general ticket, a Derby ticket. So even if somebody doesn't want to fish in a Derby but would like to participate, they can buy a ticket and they can have a chance of being drawn and have a chance to win $25,000 in a high five drawing.
I'm talking to Wayne Riglin and Cammie Bartness about the Salmon Derby coming up this August 12th through the 14th. I'm going to ask you your favorite Salmon Derby memory if you can, please.
Well, I've fished the Derby now for 19 years. I think it was about 6 or 7 years ago when they still did have the tagged fish. The guy I was fishing with, my fishing partner, is Mal Linthwaite, and he caught the tagged fish. And they tagged 12. They used to do, when they did this, they tagged 12 fish, and one of them was worth $100,000 and the other 11 were worth $1,000. And you don't know that. So you take it in and then they have to call the insurance place and all that. And it was, we won $1,000. But that was pretty exciting. And,
remember that. And this brought year, a fish to me.
And this year, the Derby is dedicated. Every year we dedicate the Derby to someone that's done a lot of work for the Derby in the past and for territorial sportsmen. And this year it's dedicated to Mal Linthwaite. He's was chair of the Derby, I think, three or four times. He's been on the Territorial Sportsman's Board of Directors for 14 years and just been very involved for a long time. This year he was the prize chair, and he and Ron Somerville were prize chair, co-chairs. A marvelous job. That's why we have such wonderful prizes. We're going to give away $102,000 worth of prizes in cash at the end of the Derby. There's lots and lots of special prizes that I didn't have time to mention, but you need to get the Derby booklet that you'll get when you buy your Derby ticket, or it's been inserted into the newspapers here in town, and it has all these special prizes that you can read about, or you can look it at on our website, which is www.goldennorthsalmonderby.org.
Can be your favorite Salmon Derby memory?
Oh, I think it might have been the same year, but it was about 6 years ago, and we had a record number of fish. I want to say it was over 56,000 pounds of fish turned in total, and I was at Ogg Bay, and our whole float was underwater because we had six full totes, people still lined up to bring in their fish, and we were literally had our boots all the way up, and the whole float was underwater because we couldn't get the fish moving fast enough that we were overwhelmed, and everybody was just having a blast, and it was so much fun.
You know, I was going to say, the Derby is a great deal of fun, but it's also really important because it's a community event. Everybody participates, and then we sell these fish, and we give away scholarships. Since we started doing that in 1952, of course, I wasn't here then, but that started giving away scholarships then, and over the years, we've given $1.5 million of scholarships to Juneau kids. The scholarships for college are now $12,000 per year, or no, per student. And last year we gave four scholarships to high school kids going on to college, and then two $2,500 vocational scholarships for kids that were going to go to vocational school. That's a good thing.
I'll say. Well, anything you'd like to add, Amanda, if you're going to ask?
It looks like we're going to have a wonderful, good weather for the Derby. I don't know if it'll be sunny, but it's not going to be windy. And there are a lot of fish out there.
They're catching cohos, and their
cohos are big. Last week I caught one that was 19 pounds. It is just the biggest cohos that I've been in the ground for a long time, and there's a lot of them. So it's going to be excellent fishing. Should be a lot of fun. The community gets behind it. The businessmen are all behind it and making donations, and it's just a lot of fun.
Kelly Varnas and Wayne Regland, thank you so much for being on the show today. The Salmon Derby is August 12th through the 14th. You can get your tickets at a variety of places where you get fishing gear. Thank you again for coming down to Juneau.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Life on Earth needs fuel to run.
Talking about the chain of food.
We get our fuel from the light of the sun.
Talking about the chain of food.
How to use that sunlight energy to power the likes of you and me. Well, that's the trick you're about to see. Talking about the chain of food. Behind this dance,
talking about the chain of food,
are the quiet heroes we call plants.
Talking about the chain of food.
And the trick that only plants can do is mix water, dirt, and CO2 with sunlight and convert them to
the great stuff we call food.
So think of a leaf or a tree or a shrub,
chain, chain, chain,
as sunlight that's been changed to grub.
Chain, chain, chain.
So an antelope eats a leafy plant.
Talking about the chain of food.
Cause the plant makes stuff that an antelope can't.
Talking about the chain of food.
So the antelope gets fuel to run through the chemical trick the plant has done. With light waves shining from the sun.
Talking about the chain of food.
and all those plants the antelopes eat. Become delicious antelope meat.
Chain, chain, chain.
Just be the next link in the chain. Hear a hungry lion roar. And antelope's what she's looking for.
Something about the chain of food.
That solar power she's gonna score was stored as plant and herbivore. And now it'll fuel this carnivore.
Talking about the chain of food.
So that's how light waves from our star
chain, chain, chain.
Can turn up at the salad bar
chain, chain, chain.
And out there where the wild things are.
Music by Tom Chapin, ushering us into this next interview with Darren Snyder, who's involved with the 4-H and also the 4-H Sustainable Harvest Fair or Camp, which is coming up next week for youth ages 11 to 18. It starts next Tuesday and goes through Friday. Darren, thank you very much for coming into the station today.
You're welcome, Jeff. Thanks a lot for having me.
So an overview of the camp, please.
Yeah, so this is a 4-H camp. It's an overnight camp starting on next Tuesday, the 16th. And so campers ages 11 to 18 are welcome to join us there, and I'll tell you more about how to sign up. But the camp is going to be Tuesday starting at about noon on going through Tuesday night and through Wednesday, through Thursday, and then finishing up on Friday early in the afternoon. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday of next week. And the camp is designed to help youth have the opportunity to learn some of the Alaskan skills, the basic skills of harvesting, and how can we do that sustainably. We'll be entering into those topics in a variety of ways. The camp is going to include harvesting of cultivated products, including garden products such as Tlingit potatoes and carrots and such, and rhubarb, and then also doing some wild harvest of berries and tubers from the chocolate lilies, and then we're going to get into some of the animals, some salmon, and as long as the hunt is successful, then we'll also have a deer to process and go through that process of learning how to process these products safely and properly, and how to smoke, can, preserve all of these products. It's going to be a whole lot of fun, and we've got many great adults to help out with the process here. Some that are flying in to be with us all week, and others that are going to come in and just kind of teach to their specialty. So it's going to be we're also going to be doing some kayaking. We're going to be based out at Saga, the Eagle Valley Center out there. There's a beautiful lodge that Saga has out on CBJ land. They're a great partner. And we're going to be getting on kayaks and kayaking around over to another CBJ land out at the Arboretum with Merrill Jensen out there. And we're going to do some harvesting of the garden out there. And we're not only going to take, but we're going to give back to the garden. And that's a lot of the theme of sustainability is how do we feed what feeds us. And so we're going to be harvesting seaweed from the shore and bringing it back to the garden and feeding that soil, which in turn grows those great vegetables which we harvest and eat. So that's some of what we're up to, and other activities around. We're going to be hiking around. We're going to be learning about navigation, mapping. Another one of our wonderful partners, many of you know Kristen Romanoff with Fish and Game. She's going to be coming in and helping out for a few of those days that we've got out there, and bringing her expertise. And so, yeah, it's going to be a wonderful camp. And this is kind of a reinvigorating and a rebuilding of the wonderful 4-H camp tradition that we've had here in Southeast with a different twist. And we look at offering this every year for years to come. This first group of youth are looks like primarily the signups are around 11, 12, 13-year-olds. And part of what we're looking at is that these kids who are coming these years may develop into the leaders for coming years to help run the camp as older teens. So that's part of the vision for how this camp is going to run for years to come.
And how many of you are involved?
So far, a little less than 20, and so we do have a few more slots, and we're going to be maxing out this year at around 20 youth. So if you do have a youth out there who might be interested in this kind of thing, please give me a call on my office phone. It's 796-6281. There may even be a few of you out there who have already called, and we're in the process of getting all the final paperwork and everything out to you and returning all those calls. So there's a lot of interest out there, and we've got you on the list, and we're looking forward to having your kids have a great time out there.
You're squeezing a lot of activities into that 4 days.
Yeah, you know, it's there's going to be a degree of flexibility, of course. We are planning for the weather, as all of us in Southeast have to do, and I think that's just going to be part of the theme, is how do we deal with this varying Southeast environment. And so if it turns out to be that, we do get that deer earlier than we expect, then we will go ahead and process that when we have it. And if we have campfire activities planned and it's downpouring, well, then we'll have some indoor activities. So we'll be flexible. We're going to combine some crafts in there also. Some different wilderness safety and survival practices. That's really a vital part of the learning, is how to be safe when you're outdoors. And that's why we've picked this age of youth, because these 11 on up year olds are starting to venture a little bit further into the forests and out to the beaches, and we want to empower them to be able to make the most of this wonderful, beautiful environment that we have, but safely. So that's the goal.
And this is all happening at the Saga Eagle Valley Center. People stay there too?
Yeah. The youth will be staying there as the camp, part of the camp, and they have lodging there available for all of our kids. And so that's how it's gonna go down.
And the price fee?
It's $100, which is very reasonable. We have some support through the 4-H Leaders Council, and there may be another grant that's going to help offset some of our fees. We're fishing around for some support from different groups in town for to help us out with some of our food needs. We're doing that as we speak. And if any of you out there have any donations that you'd like to give to help this camp be successful, either camping related gear or food to help feed the campers, especially local foods, local harvest. If you've got anything that you'd like to share with our camp, please give me a call, 796-6281, and be happy to make good use of that and have it go into these growing young bodies who are wanting to learn about this.
And what's the best way for people to sign up?
Again, just call me on my phone. Also, you can go to our website. If you just Google Juneau, Alaska 4-H, Juneau, Alaska Cooperative Extension, that's probably your best way to do it. I have the address right here, but why memorize it when you could just Google it? So, if $100 is sounding kind of steep to you, there are scholarships through the City and Borough Parks and Rec that you can bring our application form in there, and at the same time as you have that application, you can apply for a scholarship through City and Borough, and they're up to $100 scholarship, which just happens to match what our entry registration fee is. And then there are other scholarship possibilities too, so don't let that stop you. If it's an income or if it's an ability to pay issue, please don't let that keep you from and your kid from joining us at this camp. We want it to be open to all.
Sounds like an awesome experience.
Yeah, I sure hope so. It's going to be great. It's going to be great.
Dan Snyder, if anybody needs any more information, that phone number one more time, please.
796-6281.
Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No, but this is kind of our final end of the summer event for many kids to come back to the fall and say, hey, you know, I did this great experience, and I look forward to doing it next year.
Dan, thank you for going by.
You're welcome, Jeff. Thank you.
And here is the writer's almanac for Tuesday. It's the 9th of August, 2011. Henry David Thoreau's Walden was published on this day in 1854 by the Boston publishing house of Ticknor and Fields. 2,000 copies. It cost $1 each. It took 5 years to sell out the original print run, and then Walden went out of print. A book in which Thoreau wrote, "Cultivate poverty like a garden herb, like sage. Do not trouble yourself much to get new things, whether clothes or friends. Turn the old, return to them. Things do not change, we change. Sell your clothes and keep your thoughts. God will see that you do not want society. If I were confined to a corner of a garret all my days, like a spider, the world would be just as large to me while I had my thoughts about me." He wrote about his time out at the pond. "There were times when I could not afford to sacrifice the bloom of the present moment to any work, whether of the head or hands. I love a broad margin to my life. Sometimes in a summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I sat in my sunny doorway from sunrise till noon, wrapped in a reverie amidst the pines and hickories and sumacs, in undisturbed solitude and stillness, while the birds sang around or flitted noiseless through the house, until by the sun falling in at my west window or the noise of some traveler's wagon on the distant highway, I was reminded of the lapse of time. I grew in these seasons like corn in the night." It's the birthday of Isaac Walton, born in Stafford, England, 1593, who supported himself by writing biographies, but his great passion in life was fishing. And in 1653, Isaac Walton published The Complete Angler, or The Contemplative Man's Recreation, an ode to fishing. He wrote about how to catch fish. He wrote that if you fish for carp, you ought to throw into the water grains or blood mixed with cow dung or bran, maybe chicken guts, and also about how to fix fish, that after you clean the carp, you put him into a pot with some marjoram, thyme, parsley, half a handful of each, a sprig of rosemary, savory, 4 or 5 whole onions, 20 pickled oysters, 3 anchovies, and then pour claret over it. Add the rinds of oranges and lemons and boil it. And it's the birthday of the poet who said, "Until I grew up, I thought I hated everybody, but when I grew up, I realized it was just children I didn't like." Philip Larkin, born in Coventry, England, 1922. Here's a poem for today, a poem about fishing by Isaac Walton, who wrote, "Oh, the gallant fisher's life, it is the best of any. 'Tis full of pleasure, void of strife, and 'tis beloved of many. Other joys are but toys, only this lawful is, for our skill breeds no ill, but content and pleasure. In a morning up we rise, ere aurora's peeping, drink a cup to wash our eyes, leave the sluggard sleeping. Then we go to and fro, with our necks and our backs, to such streams as the Thames, if we have the leisure. When we please to walk abroad for our recreation, in the fields is our abode full of delectation, where in a brook, with a book, or a lake, fish we take, there we sit for a bit, till we fish entangle. Wrote Isaac Walton. That's the Writer's Almanac, produced by our technical director, Thomas Schweitzker. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:34, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests are members of the Strange Attractor Theater, which is performing a play at Perseverance Theater August 11th and 12th and 13th at 7:30 p.m. It's a page you can. It's called The Brand Project, and it's working title Phase 2. In the studio with me are Rebecca Noon, Aaron Magazarian, and Jed Hancock Bernard. Thank you very much for coming to the station, everybody.
Hey, how are you?
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
So first of all, what is the Strange Attractor Theater?
We're a theater company. We do devised work, so we create our own plays, and we're based out of three different cities in the United States.
Yeah, Philadelphia,
Providence,
and Juneau.
What does participatory theater mean?
It means where the audience may be incorporated in some way, and so it's a very active, three-dimensional theater. That's my version of it, at least.
Yeah, you're not always just going to watch. You might have to do.
Yeah, not in a scary way.
It's kind of scary for some audiences, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that we don't... I would never say that we specifically do participatory theater,
but
we do try to create... I think with every show we do, we're trying to create a whole universe. So from the moment you come to buy your ticket, you are entering into a different place. And maybe sometimes that's as much participation as we're going to give you. Maybe sometimes you might have to eat some pizza. I don't know.
And besides you folks, who else is in theater?
Yeah, Roblin Gray Davis. He's our Juno member.
Yes, Alaskan.
Tell me about the Brand Project. Is it, in parentheses, working title, is that really the name of the play, working title?
We don't think so.
No.
We've been, as we build the play, we're also working on the title, so... We couldn't come up with a different title by now, but sometimes Jed and Aram really like this title.
Yeah, it does kind of give us a chuckle. It is long and ridiculous. I think we like that, but we've had a lot of title jams, and but nothing that has really stuck. So we're sticking with this for now.
This is Phase 2. What's in Phase 1? Happened in Providence, Rhode Island.
Yeah, Phase 1 was in Providence in April. So Jed and I live in Providence. Aram and Roblin came down, and we did 3 weeks of intensive kind of first jamming on this Ibsen play that we're basing the Brand Project on, or as the most source material. So we presented some crazy stuff for the Providence audience that they gave us a lot of feedback afterwards, and then we gave them wine and cheese, so... Phase 1 was pretty good. We hope Phase 2 is also full of wine and cheese and jamming on the material.
For people who need to know some kind of a plot, can you describe the action sets?
Of the Brand Project?
What people will see this weekend.
Yeah, okay.
Aram.
Jed.
Rebecca.
Aram. You will see people moving in the space, but as far as the plot... the plot is coming.
It's slippery.
Yeah. I mean, today, we're standing on refrigerators, trying to sell each other the notion of hugging all the time as a universal rule. We're doing everything we can to figure out what a plot may be for this.
But it might not be a terribly plot-based show, which isn't always how we work, but it's something that I'm trying to tell myself not to be afraid of, that a story of extreme people, of living an inspirational maybe or a pure life might come through. But I think if you are someone who really needs to see point A to B on and on,
we may not be your...
Yeah, we may not be for you, but if you are, if you like to be a part of an experience, a theatrical experience and a universe, and maybe lose some of that need, it's not, you know, I don't know. Does that sound too artsy?
No, I think there will be people that you will want to characters you will want to follow.
But in the end, it could be the least linear thing that we've ever made.
Yeah, it might be.
This is inspired by a play by Ibsen. Why Ibsen and why that particular play?
Yeah. Jed?
Well, we were asked to jump off from a classic for this most recent project, and the classic that we decided to pick is not a very well-known classic, but it's a classic to a lot of Norwegians, and it's a play, the play Brand by Ibsen. And it's kind of lost to time for most people outside of Norway.
It's classically called unperformable, and the performances that have happened of it are like really, really long and intensely talky, and not a play that Americans have gotten behind, like some of his other plays like Doll's House and things like that. But this a Norwegian man, I guess, or a Norwegian American who lives in Juneau, was speaking to Art, the artistic director at Perseverance, and he was saying how the one play, Norwegian play, that he thinks that Perseverance should do, that someone should do, that Americans should know, is Brand. And I hope he comes to the showing. And I hope he's not that he thinks that we did okay with some of the ideas, because we're certainly not doing the play.
Yeah.
It's more like it was a space. It's a big, wide-open space to jump off into. There's a lot of...
it's a large diving board.
Yeah, it's like it's got huge ideas, and then it's set in a huge landscape. And
yeah, it's quite an epic, and we were turned on by that basic setting, because I think inspired by Alaska as well. So,
also the character Brand lives according to a code of all or nothing.
Yeah, all
or
nothing.
So everything is black or white. He's a very extreme character.
And Ibsen said that Brand was himself in his best circumstances.
His best self.
Which is like, it's kind of crazy, because Brand is not a character that you're not sure if you like him or not. He makes some choices that are so heartless. So we've been playing with that kind of like characters who the audience doesn't know if they should follow or not. Sometimes you really trust them, and sometimes they turn on you, and that's a rich place.
But in the end, his moral code leaves him lonely and at the top of a mountain covered in snow, so...
Yeah, the avalanche takes him.
We kind of alluded to the audience being scared sometimes when they're seeing live performance. What about the actors themselves? You mentioned jumping off a diving board. Is it kind of strange and scary or thrilling or exciting at the same time?
I mean, for sure, this process, not necessarily the performing of it, but some of the... coming to terms with what we're going to actually do has been complicated and difficult and a struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the crucible of making it is, rehearsals can often be really fun, and it can also be scary too when you come in and say, what are we making today? So, because we're fully responsible for the content. And so, but I mean, as performers, I mean, there's always... I think once we get to perform something that we psych ourselves up, and there's the pleasure of doing that. It's so great when there are people in the room to perform for. And so, yeah, that seems to be less of an issue than what is it that we are putting forward today.
So I totally... Sometimes if I'm performing in the middle, I might look and, like, have this weird realization of... like, oh my God, what am I doing in front of all these people? And then I think about how I could do anything that I wanted to, and they just have to watch me. And sometimes I do.
Sounds like a lot of this is improvisational.
Yeah, we create it through improv. And because this is still a working phase of the show, we for sure continue to improvise our way. Last night we did, like, a little invited rehearsal for some of the theater staff, you know, and we definitely ended up improvising an entire scene in front of them. But they didn't know that we were improvising.
But that's
because
not
we're that good.
Yeah. But that's not what we do. Yeah, we are that good. Well, we don't do that when something is sort of finished, as it were. Things get set. And so the improvisation is a process to find, to discover and find, and then things eventually will get set. They'll crystallize.
Yeah, improvisation is not the end.
Yeah.
You're doing the brand project phase two. Is there going to be a phase three, four, five, six, seven, eight?
There for sure is a phase three. It's happening in Providence in March 2012. And then the ideal is that is the finished, that's when we present the finished play. I use air quotes there, finished play. But, you know, and then it would be available for touring, and we're hoping to bring it to festivals maybe, or bring it places, maybe bring it back to Alaska when it's done as well. It's a hope. But yeah, if it's not done at phase three, the deadline is our own to contend with. So.
And the four of you have in common your participation and graduation. You all graduated from the London International School of Performing Arts?
That's right.
Yeah, that's right, including Roblin. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Roblin did.
Tell me about that, please, if you could.
One
of you.
It's in London, and it's an international school.
Yes.
For performing arts.
And it's truly international. In our class, we had people from India, from Hong Kong, mm-hmm. from Germany, from Puerto Rico, Argentina.
Yeah, everywhere.
Israel.
But it's a school where you learn, it's based on the teachings of Jacques Lecoq, but it's now being sort of taken over, taken in a new direction. This is the head of the school is taking what he learned by teaching and running the Lecoq School and helping to create the theater of the future is sort of that's what I got out of it. That's what I'm supposed to be doing now with my MFA from there, is making the theater of the future.
What was the most important concept each of you got from the London School of the Performing Arts?
For me, I don't know if it's a concept, but as far as a practice of how to be present on stage in front of people, learning to breathe was really probably the most important thing that I learned at that school. And someone telling you to breathe doesn't really work. You have to kind of go through a process. It took me a year before I started to breathe, and then and I've been breathing ever since.
You're very good at breathing.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're the best.
Don't stop.
Yeah, let's listen.
Yeah. I'm known for this.
I think I got that. The thing that keeps coming back to me is that you have to keep going. You have to keep putting yourself out there in the space every day. And now that we're working as a company and working on also producing theater, I think that continues to be something that there are days when I think like, what is the point of all this? But I think at school, you're always challenged to keep putting stuff in front of your classmates and defending your work, and you just show up at rehearsal, and you know that as long as you keep showing up, something's going to change, and that we do this work because we're obsessed, and so we just have to keep doing it.
Jen?
Yeah, I think for me it was learning that I like to make things all the time. And so I had gone in as an actor thinking that I was going to become a better actor and get really rigorous actor training. And in a lot of ways I did, but also I learned that I need to make things, like, all the time. All the time.
I'm talking with Rebecca Moon and Aaron Magazarin and Jed.
He just made a paper airplane.
It's amazing while I was talking at the same time. Jed Hansel Brainerd, involved with the brand project, which is being performed August 11th, 12th, and 13th at 7:30 p.m. at Perseverance Theater, second stage. It's a pay as you can. We're also involved in a workshop. You want to talk about the workshop for a little bit?
Oh, yeah. So we're going to do a workshop. We were here a year and a half ago performing in Eurydice, and we did a workshop that was open to the community to learn a little bit about devising and physical theater and creating images using your body. And so we're going to jump off from there and keep giving and sharing that work. Do you guys have other stuff you think about the workshop?
It's going to be fun.
Yeah.
You're going to move around.
We had a really good time. We did, the last time I remember, we had people, it culminated in an exercise called the Battle of the Elements,
So people were in like different teams of portraying, you know, like fire and burning up their other battling, you know, with paper. It's really fun. It's really fun. You get to move around a lot.
And that workshop is scheduled for when?
Ooh, they haven't scheduled it yet. I think it's during 39 Steps, so probably in September, October.
Yeah.
And 39 Steps, a classic film by Alfred Hitchcock, being done in a slightly different way by Presbyterian Theater this season.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah. Jed?
Yeah, so it's actually a play that was made by originally by a group of devisors that was based on the movie 39 Steps. So it's originally it was two clowns who did all 120 parts or whatever from the movie. So they sort of took this big movie and condensed it down and turned it into like a quick change, fast moving show.
But now it's a cast of four. It's been done now on the West End in London and now in Broadway as well. And then Aram's sister is a stage
all
manager.
All around the world,
in,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. In Philadelphia, she was stage managing it last year. You went to see it a couple times, right?
I did. I saw it a few times from the stage manager's booth, as my sister called the show. It's a really fun show. It's technically complex. There's so many cues to call, and because there's a ton of play with theater and movies and lots of gags, and so there's a lot of lights and motion and things moving around, and so it's going to be a big challenge. They say that you lose weight doing the show because you're so active and all over the stage. And
I think for all of us, like, we just because we're devisors doesn't mean we don't we now no longer do scripted theater. It's really still pleasurable to go into scripted theater, but I'm really excited about 39 Steps because it was originally a devised show and still demands that kind of creativity and use of space and use of play. And so for us as a company to get to inhabit those four roles, it just feels like the perfect marriage of both worlds. And I think it's a total crowd pleaser. It's like, it's really fun, that show.
Yeah, it's a good time show.
Yeah.
Coming up next season, this upcoming season of Perseverance Theater, but coming up this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday is the brand project phase two, put on by the Generator, not this Generator Theater Company, the Strange Attractor Theater Company, Perseverance Theater, 7:30 at second stage. What do people need to be armed with before they see the play, philosophically?
Philosophically?
An open mind.
Comfortable shoes.
Yeah. Comfortable shoes. Don't bring your priceless jewelry.
Don't. We're terrible thieves.
Yeah, you'll steal everything you have if you're not looking.
No, and I think also, when you come, just we are still in a place where we need to hear really honestly from you how it feels to watch what we're doing. So, come with your... Come with your thoughts. And comfortable shoes, yeah.
All right, Jed Hancock, Brainerd, and Aram Agazarian, and Rebecca Noon, thank you very much for coming on the station and talking about the Brand Project Phase 2.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jeff.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange. Faces come out of the rain when you're strange. No one remembers your name when you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange. People are strange when you're a stranger. When you're alone, women seem wicked. When you're unwanted, streets are uneven. When you're down. When you're strange, when you're strange, no one remembers your name. When you're strange, when you're strange,
Imagine yourself flying alongside a magnificent bird with a 9-foot wingspan. Gavin Shire, Communications Director for American Bird Conservancy, has done just that. Gavin became an ultralight pilot while working with Operation Migration. The project is teaching endangered whooping cranes, raised in captivity, the route to migrate between Wisconsin and Florida. The birds are trained to follow ultralight planes. Before taking on whooping cranes, the project practiced with Canada geese, then trumpeter swans, and sandhill cranes. Gavin flew an ultralight during the goose and swan phases.
For somebody who is afraid of flying and always has been, this was somewhat of an unexpected turn in my life, but I found that when I was flying an ultralight, I wasn't afraid at all. It was an incredible amount of work and effort, day in, day out, and it was draining and frustrating when the birds wouldn't fly with you and when the weather wouldn't cooperate. But that just made the rewards of when it finally went right and you were up there at 1,000 feet flying perfectly in sync with these wild animals. It made it all the more rewarding. It was an incredible experience. But it was really something that I had never imagined that conservation could take me. And, you know, having worked with birds all my life, to actually be there flying with them.
You can find a link to Operation Migration at birdnote.org.
Tune in this Wednesday at 5 o'clock with me, Angelina, your host of Tideline, as I kick it with Deering and Down in the studio.
Ain't nobody gonna love you.
Don't miss it, Wednesday at 5 o'clock on KRNN 102.7.
And you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTUO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Knox Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hunet 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTUO on K210 AS 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTUO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktuo.org. We have tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon. We'll talk with organizers of women's hockey activities this winter. Tom Paul will give us a rundown on this year's Camp Damp, and internationally known director Doug Fitch will be here with a preview of his talk and slideshow tomorrow night at the Silver Bow. That Writer's Almanac Music and More tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with the low temperatures around 48 degrees, northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Cloudy skies expected on Wednesday with a chance of rain and high temperatures around 60 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday night, showers, low temperatures around 51 degrees. And the forecast for Thursday, showers likely with high temperatures around 57 degrees. We're listening to the music of Doug Adams with a Z. And we have the next is All Things Considered. Thank you for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon today. If you'd like to be on a Juno Afternoon or know someone that should be, please give me a call. My name is Jeff Brown. My phone number is 463-6425. Have a great evening.